Al Cresta, join me and my guests as we try to develop conversations of consequence. It's talk radio where God matters, looking at all life through the lens of the Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Cresta in the afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest in this hour is John Berenson. John is a retired Lutheran pastor and is a close friend of mine and has been for many years since we were together at Emory University. He is an author. He is a writer. He is now writing a series of wonderful columns at The Christian Review, thechristianreview.com. Other than being a good husband and father, he is someone who likes to cook to improve his home and collect classical music and talks about it very eloquently. The Berensons reside in Bucks County, and John is a graduate not only of Emory, but of Yale Divinity School and St. Olaf College. In 2008, he published Cross-Shaped Leadership on the Rough and Tumble of Parish Practice. John, welcome back to Church and Culture.
Thank you very much, Dale. It's good to be with you.
Now, I want our listeners to know that when you were at Emory University, you wrote your dissertation on what is called liturgical theology. Would you tell our listeners just what is liturgical theology?
It is what we normally think of as theology, talk about God and the doctrine of God, the doctrine of Christ, the doctrine of the church, the sacraments, but looked at through the lens of liturgy and public worship. It picks up really on an ancient motto from the early church, from one of the church fathers and mothers, that in Latin read, lex orandi, lex est quidendi, that is, the law of belief really is determined by the law of prayer, and so it was grounded in prayer. And so it has that kind of ancient ring to it, but it literally looks at the way our beliefs, our dogmas indeed, our doctrines are embedded in and expressed and shaped with the public worship of the community. And it's partly a linguistic study. You have to know the ancient liturgies. You have to know something about linguistics. You certainly need to know about systematic theology. But yes, it's about the linkage between.
Now, what would you say to the sort of neutral observer who goes into a Christian church, whether it's Lutheran or Episcopal or Catholic, and said, boy, they just do a lot of rituals in there. They just repeat them over and over again. Is it fair to say that liturgy is the repetition of ritual?
Well, I'm going to, you've given away what would be one public prejudice. I was almost tempted to say, why do you ask? But you've already given that. Let me put it to you this way, before delving into that in any religious studies way. Let me put it to you this way. If I go to the Philadelphia Eagles football game, I've never been to, number one, I'll be lucky if I survive, because there are certain sections of the stadium that you don't want to go to. But that being said, when you go to that, or even a baseball game, since we're in baseball season, baseball, whether you know it or not, when you grow up with it, has its rituals, it has its patterns. How do you know? Why are they standing up at the end of this, at the middle of the seventh inning? Why are they, they sing the national anthem, they do this, they do that. There's this entertainment factor that a lot of you get, in football. Why do the celebrations take place the way they do? Now, if you're an alien from another planet, you're going to say, what's this about? And your proper host would say, wouldn't give you a lecture, and wouldn't give you a justification, which is, I think, your question kind of implies. He'd say, come to the game and we'll see. And we'll hang out at the game, the football game, what is the halftime show really about, et cetera. And you'll learn by doing, and you'll learn, and it will become ingrained in you. And then after a while, you'll be doing it. So it's not like you take a seminar. Now, I know you can go to the symphony, and I've done that. We go to the symphony, and an hour before they come out and give you a lecture on Gustav Mahler, then you hear the symphony. Well, that's fine. But it's not really like that. It's about being, you know, you're going to listen to that whole symphony and let it just sweep you away. And then later on you can reflect on it. Later on can you say, why did they do that kneeling down? Why did they do that crossing themselves? So I would approach it that way. I'd say, let's go to church and we'll have coffee afterward and talk about why it's so weird.
I'm talking with John Berenson, a retired Lutheran pastor whose dissertation and longtime interest, I would say lifelong interest, is in liturgy and the theology of liturgy. Let's follow that, John, the example you just gave, the analogy.
And we're getting one other example, too. It must be even more contemporary. One of the popular shows that my wife and I watch all the time, and we even do the binge-watching, is Blue Bloods on Friday night, you know, the police show in New York City, which is kind of a police and family show. For those of your listeners who know about Blue Bloods, there's a certain pattern to that show, and what happens at the end of every episode or the beginning or the middle? Now, I think most of your listeners who watch are going to say they're sitting around the family dining room after Mass on Sunday, and they're discussing things. And, you know, sometimes it's tense and sometimes it's humorous, but you still have to stick around the table and put up with one another and pass the potatoes. And all kinds of things get negotiated. Well, to me, that's how I grew up thinking of what liturgy and worship truly is and how I explain it to, say, young people. So think of Blue Bloods if you like that show. And that you know, you must be present there on Sunday or there's a gap in it, you know, like Elijah's missing from that. So I wanted to add that.
Well, there are both your analogies are apt and helpful. And I want to point out that the first analogy to baseball and football is perhaps can perhaps be described as the rules of the game. But now, that's not a complete explanation, but certainly a lot of the rituals of football and baseball are the way they are because of the rules of the game. And your example of the TV series Blue Bloods is more of the necessity of the narrative of Blue Bloods. So you have, on the one hand, rules as part of the baseball ritual and the necessity of narrative, beginning, middle, and end of a story with Blue Bloods. Now, are rules and narrative involved in Christian liturgy?
Well, of course. But not rules in the sense that one might think, such as thou shalt not and thou shalt, you know, do's and don'ts, so much as, well, when you think of rules of a game, if there are no rules to Monopoly or whatever your game is, there is no game. Then it's just, you know, I think of it's a food fight at that point, and you're a crowd. So rules in this sense are these binding little elements of community. And it has less to do with a list, although for sure even in liturgy, especially when you study it, if you're a student in the seminary for the priesthood or the ministry, you get a lot of books that will give you certain rules of thumb for how you construct the liturgy, what the history behind a particular section of it is. But it's really still more along the baseball analogy. If you don't have the rules, it's not like everybody's, you know, misbehaving. It's as if there is no game.
And you understand it through that. Now, before we go on, I want to clarify something. You know, among the Christian denominations, people sometimes talk about liturgical worship versus non-liturgical worship. Now, I was a Southern Baptist, as you know, for many years, and there was definitely a kind of accepted liturgy to a Southern Baptist worship. So we're really talking in terms of literature across the board, correct?
Exactly. I mean, that's one of those, if you're talking as a pundit would or as a critic would from the outside, what you don't see is if I go to a Pentecostal service, if I go to a Russian Orthodox service, if I go to a Lutheran, if I go to a Catholic, if I go even to a Quaker meeting, there will be there either in a hidden form or it will be overt. There will be a ritual pattern. There's no such thing as praying and worshiping with no pattern. Completely, at least if you're in the public sphere, because we're talking here about public prayer, public worship. So yeah, I mean, you know, if I'm in a Pentecostal service, there is, we may not say Kyrie eleison, and we may not have an acclamation before the reading of the scripture. We may not have versicles, but there are still going to be the elements of liturgy, just like the elements of music. You know, there's gesture, there are words, and it's just that there'll be patterned differently. But there is no unpatterned worship. Unpatterned worship is what I call the food fight.
Well, aren't there religious denominations, Christian and non-Christian, who claim to have non-pattern worship?
Sure, yeah. But here's the same thing I would say about people who, and this is a parallel response about when I was talking about atheist friends or my relatives who like to
play. Well, I'm thinking of Quakers.
Well, yeah, but if you go, there's a definite thought, and there is a structure. There is a suggested structure sitting there in the silence as to when you stand up, when you make your witness, et cetera, how you go about it. If I were to barge into a Quaker meeting and start maybe acting like I might when I was an adolescent, I'm not sure that would work. So, no, I don't think there is any, now by liturgical, people mean some repetitive phrases. If they mean certain ceremonial elements, well, see, what some people mean by liturgy is the ceremonial dimensions of public gathering. And that too, but that's a subset under liturgy. Liturgy, an ancient word, means the work of the people, liturgia. And it's a community function. So, yes, you may not like, let me give you another example. My wife was raised Roman Catholic and a practicing Catholic. She's been a Lutheran now for 30 years, God help her. And she's still adjusting to why we sing the hymns so long. I just tell her, it is what it is, and that's how I got my pension. So just don't ask, But when she goes to Mass with her mother on Saturday night, if I go with Grandma, it's interesting to observe my wife's behavior compared to when she's in the Lutheran parish on Sunday morning. When she walks in, she may revert to certain patterns of things, like kneeling before and crossing herself before sitting down. Now, she would never do that in a Lutheran church. But it's just that the stuff comes back because it's ingrained in her psyche and her being. And it's not a show, and I respect it. And another example would be when I was a young person, I never would have crossed myself. Well, I've been doing it for many years now because crossing myself is a wordless act, for things that can't be said in words. But a lot of people, what they mean by liturgy is when there's a lot of ceremonial action, physical action, or repetitive phrases. But that's a very kind of, that's not what liturgy is. Liturgy is a community function, the way we were talking about it in Blue Bloods. It really is.
You mean it's like gathering at table and saying your blessing and carving the turkey properly and...
And somebody, even the youngest person, maybe even the junior high person who's in a rebellious stage of life is going to say, I was here last Christmas. Where are the mashed potatoes that Grandma used to make? Okay, that's the terms in which I want to put it. And someone's going to say, it's never been the same since her sweet potatoes weren't here. You know what I mean? That's what we're talking about here. If we want to be genuine as to what the traditions are trying to say by their worship patterns.
Well, take what you're saying and apply it to the sort of trauma that shook the Catholic Church after Vatican II, when the entire liturgy came out of Latin and was put into the vernacular. How do you look at that as a liturgical theologian?
Well, and I remember my teachers in the seminary. I was blessed when I was at Yale Divinity School. They had what they called the Notre Dame invasion. Father Henry Nouwen had been at Notre Dame, and so had another person who not widely known to the public, Father Aidan Cavanaugh, who was a Benedictine and one of the leading liturgists in the world at the time, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. He's passed on now. And so I was, you know, I was blessed because those folks could share with us what it was like from the inside, you know, as a Catholic, and especially Father Kavanaugh, in terms of what the positives and the negatives had happened. Now, the average layperson might have said, and often did, in Catholicism, you know, we lost the mystery. Then there would be claims about the deans and some kind of expression or freedom. And back and forth to what I would call the superficial arguments went. But, when, you know, there was no question if you were saying, in turbo ad altera Dei, at the beginning of the Mass, I would go up to the altar of God. That's at least, it's certainly poetically much more powerful than, hey, you all come and worship. And so some of it, too, was a lack of artfulness, I felt. In the immediate aftermath of Vatican II, and we were affected by this in Protestantism, the translations of the liturgical texts or the inventions of new ones, to be honest with you, there was no Robert Frost writing them, if I can just be honest. Some of it was quality control. But even now, when I get materials from my national church headquarters in the Lutheran Church, sets of prayers, sets of intercessions, sometimes, again, I can tell, this was not written by Emily Dickinson. This was written by a committee with Joe Schmo running it.
Right.
And a lot of times those are the issues because some of this stuff requires great, great care to, you know, even if it's in the vernacular. So it's not the fault of the vernacular, but we're pretty clumsy is what I would say.
Talking with John Berenson about the meaning of liturgy, and he is giving the argument that liturgy is not just something common to worship, but also to most human activities, including sports and family gatherings, and probably most of what we do. But then the question becomes, why do Christians have this specific form of liturgy they have?
And the answer to that is very clear and ecumenically agreed upon because of the gospel itself and how it came into history and the patterns that emerged in the ancient church. The very nature of the Christian gospel of incarnation, the Trinity, God in human flesh, God taking on, you know, Martin Luther would say a sacrament is defined as something that used earthly stuff, you know, wine, grapes, water, and then it's matched with words, but the words contain the promise of God. I therefore forgive you all your sins. The very way in which the Christian gospel came into existence in this kind of embodied form starts to imply these kind of, you know, what I would call mediated media. It implies media. You don't just worship in your spiritual brain. You know, it requires the medium of your humanity. And I'm not sure if that's what you were getting to, but let me put it another way. One of the exercises we do, I'm teaching confirmation tonight. We call it CCD because my pastor is on vacation and I'm substituting with the teenagers tonight. So, you know, pray for me now in the hour of my death. Amen. But one of the things we do when we teach sacraments, we'll do something like this. I'll say, okay, here's the wall board. I'm going to make two columns. On the right-hand column, I want you to list everything that happens, and this goes back to the blue bloods. List everything that happens at the family meal at the holidays. What was in the room? Who was in the room? What's going on? The whole environment listed. Then, on the left-hand side, I say, now let's talk about what just happened in church yesterday. And they are amazed about the connected dots of again, those things of humanity that are connected with that. I don't know if that's at all helpful.
It is, but when we look at Lutheran liturgy and Roman Catholic liturgy are still very similar. Is that correct?
Structurally, from what we would call in the modern liturgical scholars like to speak of what they call the ordo, O-R-D-O. That's a fancy way of saying, when you go back to ancient times and follow it all the way through today, through the hiccups in the Reformation, which had some reforming of some of the patterns and the exclusion and the pruning out of some elements, especially sacrificial elements, by the way. That was the point of controversy for Protestants versus Roman Catholics, a lot of the language of sacrifice was looked upon very warily by Protestants. So there would be that kind of micromanaging. But when you look at the larger patterns, what leads into a service up to the reading of scriptures and the word, and then you come to the table, you know, the table and the sacrament, and you think of the font and baptism, you will often hear a liturgical scholar saying all Christian liturgy of all sorts follows a, quote, ordo. Not an order as in you better do it, but when you reduce it down to its focal points, its focal points always have something to do with word, meal, and they don't even say bath. Now, how it gets dressed up, I would call, you know, the window dressing of it, is then becoming a part of a lot of our style things and dispute things. You can walk into a church, and you can get along without a Kyrie, but you're not going to get along without reading the scriptures, right?
Or having a homily.
Right. Yeah. There are certain occasions you might, you know, the exception maybe Passion Sunday and that, in which case the whole liturgy is considered to be a proclamation. But yeah, you can say, we're not going to do Kyrie this week. In fact, we're not going to do glory to God. We might not even do an acclamation. But nobody can take a vote and say we're not going to read the Bible. I mean, that's, you know, in the same way with, no one's going to say, I don't like communion because it makes me feel weird, so we're just never going to do it. Or we're going to use hamburgers because I like it. So, I mean, those are extreme examples, but there are historical focal points to a Christian celebration. And if you look at them, every one of them somehow derives from the scriptures and the gospel itself.
Aren't most of them found in Jewish liturgy as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. In fact, the early Christian liturgy, and this is what some of the, like a historian like Father Kavanaugh taught us and has been taught ever since, is that Christian worship, whether you're talking Lutheran, Baptist, Calvinist, Roman Catholic, Russian Orthodox, when you look at that order, when you look at that pattern, by the way, there was a famous book in the 50s by the Benedictine Dom Gregory Dix called The Shape of the Liturgy, and he was the one who revealed this kind of pattern. When you find out that its roots are in the synagogue and in, not in the sacrificial worship of the temple time, but in synagogue worship and in Passover worship, as well as the routine of Friday night Shabbat. And really, the Christian worship is a merger of, because synagogue worship was readings, prayers, and preaching, and singing. When the temple was destroyed, all the Jews had left was, you were no longer worshiping by the use of sacrifices. You got together, you sang, you read the prophets, you read the Torah, you prayed, you sang, you preached. Well, think of that. That's the front part of any liturgy. Then, the back part of any liturgy, a sacramental part, with bread and wine, really comes not only from Passover celebrations, but what will happen in this Friday night in many Jewish homes around the world. You know, the patterns of the cups of wine, the three cups of wine, and the various breads and that. Yeah, our patterns of worship are directly related in Jewish patterns.
Have you ever been in a situation, I'm talking with John Berenson, a liturgical theologian of Lutheran stripe, have you ever been in a situation, liturgical situation, in which something went wrong, something was left out, and everybody knew it, everybody felt it, it kind of jarred everybody?
Give me an example. I could probably, yes, think of them, but I'm not sure what you mean by that something was left out. The trick question there is, as we Lutherans would say, much of liturgy is adiaphora, that is, things indifferent. Martin Luther and Philip Melanchthon would say that is, ceremonial elements in our tradition, in our Lutheran tradition, ceremonial elements are considered, you know, like chicken soup. It might hurt, it can hurt and it might help, but it's not necessary for any kind of valid celebration. So if someone's going to, depends on what you're talking about leaving out. I've been in awkward moments. Some of it has to do with presiding. You're a presider, you're a priest, you're assistant ministers, you're pastor. This gets all into how one presides. and things go wrong. That's you're asking if things go wrong logistically in a service. If things go wrong logistically, or a man has to be carried out in an ambulance. I don't know if you're talking about that kind of thing.
Well, no, I don't.
I've had stories as pastors. Oh, I can tell you, I can name. Being the fellow that had to be carried out in ambulances, and it wasn't because of the preaching. You know, it was, you know, the guy had a heart attack in church. So what do you do? You know, that, there's that. But you're talking about if I became offended by the absence or the presence of an element in the service. Is that
right.
What you're saying?
Yes.
You
know, it's probably the nature of the kind of ritual we're talking about. That just doesn't really happen, does it?
Well, part of the meaning of a liturgy, however type or loose you want to define it, is that it's meant to hedge that. It's meant to hedge that. Let me give you an example from I heard one of our scholars about 20 years ago say this, and it again comes from the non-religious word, but it goes back to the function of liturgy and how it covers us. It covers our flaws too. I heard this analogy. Dick Cavett once, on the old Dick Cavett show, which was a wonderful show, Dick Cavett had a prominent guest on, a very prominent person. And apparently, Dick Cavett noticed, and it was live at the time, and no one else did initially, that the man's thigh was down. And but nobody had noticed it at this point, but Dick Cavett had noticed it. And he did the following. In this particular, he said to whoever this was, you know, Burt Lancaster or somebody, now, I'm going to ask everybody to do something. He stopped the show. He said, I want everyone in the audience and all of us here up on the stage to turn around with our backs to one another, and we're going to turn around all at one time with our backs to one another, and we're all going to zip up our pants. So he did this kind of ritual thing, and then he said, okay, everybody turn back around and sit down. And everybody was like, what's this about? And he said, I just covered you all. You know, and someone once explained to me that a liturgy which is healing and well done can do this for us. It can do this for us. That may sound extreme, but I really, really
No, that's a great... A great illustration. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about the reason and meaning of liturgy in our lives. And please stay with us. We'll be back right after this message.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. Are you a beacon of faith or a bunker? Pope Francis often reminds us to let Jesus out, to get out of our bunker modes of church and take Christ to the rest of the world. In Matthew chapter 18, Christ commands us to go therefore and make disciples of all nations. This gospel passage makes it clear that we are to take our good message, all our good stuff, outside of our churches and ourselves to the world at large. And all the activities of the mystical body of Christ should be ordered to mission. In short, we are called to be beacons of Christ's love and meet the world where it lives. And do not fear, you have everything you need to carry Christ to the world by virtue of your baptism and confirmation. You are equipped, and when you surrender to Him, He will work through you. So, the question remains, are you a beacon or a bunker?
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
I think I'm pregnant.
Really? What are you going to do?
What choice do I have?
She has a choice. It's ICUDetroit.com. Image clear ultrasound or ICU in the womb. We bring hope to women in need. And where there's hope, there are life-affirming choices. We are Michigan's first mobile ultrasound unit, servicing the Detroit metro area, providing free pregnancy tests, ultrasounds, and non-judgmental peer counseling. All services and care take place in our spacious mobile unit, which has a private exam room with a state-of-the-art 3D ultrasound and a separate lounge area for family or friends. If your church, congregation, or youth group is interested in learning more about this ministry, please call 248-620-5353 or visit us at ICUDetroit.com. That's the letters ICUDetroit.com or 248-620-5353. ICUDetroit.com.
I'm back with Pastor John Berenson, whose speciality theologically is liturgy, among other things. And we're talking about why we have liturgy, how they mean to us, and how, in fact, they benefit us. And just before the break, John, you were talking about the issue of presentation. I want to ask you about that. Should we in the pews expect a certain level of energy, a certain level of, call it, actor's ability from you pastors and priests who are presiding over the liturgy?
Absolutely, absolutely. Especially, I know you well enough, Gil, to know you're asking that not in the superficial sense of trying to hoodwink someone. I know what you're saying. People, if they're coming and placing themselves in your hands, they have a right to expect. They have a right to expect that they can trust what's now going to happen. I want to put it that way: that they can trust what's now going to happen. That you are taking it with seriousness. I've known pastors, especially back in the 60s, who would wander into the chancel, with a cup of coffee, giggling and laughing. And it's not that you have to be weeping and moaning, but you could tell they were not focused. They were not present. People have a right to expect that you are present to the proceedings. People have a right to know and to experience that you have, at some point earlier in the week or just by your experience, that you know the proceedings well enough, that you've internalized them well enough that they can entrust to you the proceedings. And people, it's largely a matter of hospitality. But if someone's going to come and sit there for an hour or 45 minutes or whatever it is, they do have a right to expect that of their leaders. It's not some sort of boring thing about dignity in that. There was a beautiful, beautiful book published by a Benedictine in the 70s that's still in print and that is used widely in seminaries throughout the world. It is called Strong, Loving, and Wise. And it is a manual for what a presider does.
I don't know that book. That surprises me.
Okay. It's widely available. Just go. It's from the Liturgical Press in Collegeville, mm-hmm. Minnesota, published by Benedictines.
Right.
And the book is called Strong, Loving, and Wise. And it is the best book that has ever been written on not only the do's and don'ts of what you do up front, there's some of that, but also the demeanor and what's going on inside of you as the presider. And I forget the gentleman's name at this point, but it's a beautiful book because it makes you understand the importance of that you are a host. I mean, if you're a priest or an assistant minister or whatever, or an usher, that you are responsible for the hospitality of that house. And you are responsible for whether they're to remove impediments from their being able to enter into their prayer. Strong, Loving, and Wise is a great, great book.
It was written by Robert W. Hovda.
Hovda, who used to be one of the editors of the famous and still published Worship magazine, which is a leading scholarly.
It's only 96 pages.
It's a very short manual. And what it really does is it's not a lot about do's and don'ts, although, it has some of that. But it's about me as a leader taking seriously what's going on and how it's like a spirituality for the leader.
The subtitle is Presiding in Liturgy.
Yeah, it has both some manual type stuff, some how to do it, but it's really more about why to do it and how to enter into it. And I can also say it's a beautiful read. You read it, and it's a very serene thing. Now, he was a Benedictine. He's gone now. He was the editor at one time, Bob Hovda, of the Worship Journal out of Collegeville, Minnesota, the Benedictine Abbey. And it's the best book in the world still. There's also one by an Episcopalian called, I forget, it's written in honor of him, too. There's an Episcopalian book that goes more into what you would call priestcraft. Now, that's kind of creepy language, but it comes down to things like, and I've prided, I don't say pride in myself, over the years, whenever I go to a new church, whenever I go to mid-church and I have to preach, and I do that a lot nowadays that I'm retired, I go out to different places. The rituals I will go through when I walk into the building to get myself ready, and I'm not talking about being psyched up. I'm talking about if I'm going to a new place. I went to some place in downtown Philadelphia near Rittenhouse Square a few weeks ago, and I had never been there before. But a pastor was on a vacation. I usually get there an hour early, not only because I'm fussing, and I like to fuss and like to make sure everything's in the right spot. I like to walk the floors and the corridors. I like to get to know, I regard it as a kind of a living organism of the place I'm coming into. I check sight lines. So, yeah, there's a stagecraft. I check sight lines. If I'm going to stand up and preach or I'm going to read this prayer, how do I get from here to here? And if I don't know, I'll ask the janitor. Because when the bell rings and the service goes off, I don't want those nice people who've come in there to see an idiot up front.
Well, there seem to be, in my experience as a Catholic now, 35 or so years, there seem to be two extremes. You have the priest who is purposely lifeless, so to speak, because it's not about him. It's all about...
That was an actual teaching. I understand, and I remember Father Kavanaugh telling us, pre-Vatican II, if you went to the seminary, it was an actual word for that, that you were literally to be robotic and so as not to distract. And there was a word for it. I forget what the word is now. And and the whole of the book will talk about what's both right and wrong with that. That I'm going to be so robotic. Well, then that itself becomes a distraction. So how do you be natural without being hip?
Yes, the other extreme is probably best termed hip.
Yeah. The question is, it's more like being a waiter at a fine meal. The way I explain it to people is, it doesn't have to be an expensive restaurant. Most people know what good service is in a restaurant. I don't care if it's a diner or if it's an upscale restaurant. Most people know what good service is. What is it? The waiter and the folks there facilitate what's happening without calling attention to themselves, and yet on the other hand, assisting you whenever they can tell that you need assistance. So they're not intrusive, but they intrude at the point you need them. So there should be a sense, I think, of timelessness. That is, a really good meal, you're not so much aware of the passage of time. If it's a poorly managed meal by the wait staff, you're either going to be rushed or it's going to drag, right?
Yes.
So, what's it like when it's real? Again, I'm not talking about an expensive restaurant. You know you're getting a good experience when you're able to enter into the meal and your conversation with your partner without either being distracted by haste or by, waste.
There's a kind of rhythm you try to catch?
Yeah, you try to catch it. And so you have to kind of, the one thing that's true about the old pre-Vatican II thing, you as the leader, you do have to kind of empty yourself. You do have to kind of empty yourself. On the other hand, that doesn't mean you are unhuman. So it comes back to Robert Holmes' thing, strong, loving, and wise. How can you, what is a gracious host like? We all know what a gracious host is like. They make things happen. They facilitate things. They let you know they care, but they don't sit in there and try to tell you jokes in the meantime. And that's my model for leading in public ritual of whatever kind. And then personal presence.
You talked about the moments in which you, or it's appropriate for a good waiter to intrude their personality. Is that appropriate at the homily moment?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, and then again, it's how you do it. It's again how, for instance, I probably use a lot of personal anecdotes in the sermon, but what I've learned, I think, well over the years, with my family's help, is how to do it without calling attention to myself so much as the point it's trying to make. Now, I've seen people talk about their children and this and this and this in the sermon, and it ends up being, well, it was nice to hear about the kids, but I never heard about Jesus, And so there's a certain artfulness. If I'm going to tell a story about being lost, like the lost and found, I could tell the story about how I got lost in an Easter egg hunt when I was a child, which I was, and I had to be picked up by the police because I got lost. No, it's true. That's why I was forced into the ministry. It was a matter of penance. So the question is, how can you tell that story or reference it in such a way that they're not just going away hearing about an Easter egg hunt, but something about the gospel? And the only cure for that is experience. You got to know how to do it over time.
You know, I often wonder why it is that any preacher, whether Catholic or not, reads a homily.
Now you're getting into preaching and you're getting into homiletics. Now, in homiletics, there are a lot of ecumenical traditions now. The one modern benefit for how homiletics is taught, whether it's the priests or ministers, it's taught both through rhetoric and public speaking skills and also how to integrate it into the service so that it's not just totally freestanding. You're not just a pulpiteer. There was a time when they used to talk about so-and-so is a prince of the pulpit, you know, somebody who was just, you know, downtown New York, you know.
Yeah, Dagger John Hughes, a famous Cardinal Archbishop of New York, had that.
Who was that?
Dagger John Hughes. He was the Cardinal Archbishop of New York and started the construction of St. Patrick's Cathedral.
Yeah, one of these people that people came in droves just to hear the rhetoric?
Correct.
Yeah, well, there are two extremes, obviously. Again, it goes back, I think, to the whole thing, how to be gracious and how to be – it's how to be integrative. I mean, I'm using, you know, kind of stupid words, but how can it be natural? How can it be integrated into life, and yet it's still dominated by the narrative of the text?
Of the gospel reading?
Or the other readings, too. No, I mean, I've heard great sermons on – just someone preaching on the responsorial psalm. I mean, this Sunday in most every church, probably Catholic churches too, this is called Good Shepherd Sunday in most Christian churches. You're going to hear not only the story of Jesus saying, I am the good shepherd watches for his sheep. You're going to get to sing or say this Sunday, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, etc. Now, you can preach a great sermon just on the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, as long as you're making some other references to the gospel, et cetera, but no, and you can preach on the Old Testament. This is what Luther called law and gospel. You can preach on the Old Testament lesson and make it sound like gospel. So, yeah, there's, you know.
Yes, we Catholics do observe Good Shepherd Sunday, which is the fourth Sunday of Easter.
Yeah, and so this Sunday, everybody's going to get to sing or say, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. Well, you as a priest or a minister, you must assume, and you usually do, that the people who are in the room this Sunday, if that's going to push all kinds of buttons in their personal lives, about recent deaths, about scary experiences, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, if you're a good priest or a minister, you're going to know this week as you're prepping, but you should assume that the people who walk into church this Sunday, that's gonna push something going on in their lives.
So in other words, the presider may have a fixed liturgy, but the presider's got to make decisions about things that are, how shall I say, flexible.
Yeah.
Within that liturgy.
Yeah. Because, people are, these are adults, they're trusting you to do that on their behalf so that they can get on and ponder the good news and maybe even the bad news, the law. I mean, exactly. How can you be firm yet flexible with that? And so there's no substitute, by the way, and every priest and minister would say it, there's no substitute for a minimum of 10 years of experience before you start to get this. It follows, what was that, the 10,000 hours, 10-year rule that you've heard about?
Yes.
I don't think any minister or priest, unless they're just a, you know, some of us are better actors than others, as you say. And you can get away with acting for so long. But I would say, like every other high-level skill-type thing that goes on in public, you need about 10 years or 10,000 hours before you find your sea legs in terms of being able to read the congregation appropriately. Now, back to your thing about reading a homily. There's a trick there. Winston Churchill sounded spontaneous, didn't he?
Yes.
Every single word was scripted. But Winston Churchill was such a master rhetorician, you didn't know that. So I always tell it to my family who says, well, that pastor just read that sermon. I'll say, well, he might have, or just this guy's deadpan. I mean, he might have just had a couple of notes there, but it sounded like he was reading. So don't assume. Now, some manuscripts, in other words, I preach manuscripts and I preach no manuscripts. But the key, once again, is, has it been integrated into you? Even if I use a manuscript, literal manuscript, I never use it that way.
Right.
So the whole idea of reading a sermon doesn't necessarily mean reading. It has something to do with the lack of rhetorical skill on the part of the preacher.
John, when I was a Baptist minister, the first time I was asked to pray publicly in church, I wrote a prayer, spent a lot of time on it, and I read it. And then on the way out, one elderly man pulled me aside and said, you know you didn't pray.
Right, I gotcha.
And what do you mean? It says, well, you read it. You read of something, but that's not how you pray.
Yeah, but again, I have to say, I understand where the gentleman was coming from, but what he was saying and what you experienced and what you did, it both is and is not true. If you had memorized that prayer, or you just use it as a kind of glancing blow to your mind, you might have gone off on some tangents and this and that. And that's what he was expecting. I'll be honest, I don't have any patience for that kind of argument, because it still comes down to the responsibility of the leader to be so, to have so internalized, I'll use that word, to have so internalized the proceedings, the physical proceedings, the sight lines, the words, that it literally has taken over. I'll be honest, if you're a good preacher or a priest, the proceedings should have possessed you.
Well, what I find interesting is that we began with this conversation of ritual, which most people can seem kind of a rote thing, and now you're talking about internalization, which seems to be quite different.
Well, rote, I mean, you can be rote in a Baptist church, can't you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so rote refers, I know what people mean when they complain. Rote refers more to the fact that there seems to be no presence, no lack, there's a lack of energy. It doesn't seem that even the group or the leaders are, quote, into it. That's what's really being referenced, I think. Because, as you know, you could go to an Orthodox service with lots of incense and this and this and this, and a lot of, quote, rote on the surface. But it can be deeply profound and make you cry. Well, that's not about what's on the page. It's about what we do with it.
How do you, I mean, one thing I find interesting is, how do we know when someone, whether the presider or even the congregation, is not, quote-unquote, into it? What kind of keys are we reading there?
I think, well, now I'm in a position now that's kind of interesting, because I sit in the, I'm not out preaching as a guest now that I'm retired. I sit in my own congregation and I sit in the choir, because I sing in the choir, and I'm able to observe the preacher. And
the congregation.
What's that? Yeah.
And the congregation.
Right. And I'm not a critic. I would almost say I just received the stimuli. I can tell when he's not into it. And I can tell when he's into it. But I can tell when, but it goes hand in hand. It's not a game. If he's not into it, they're not going to be into it. I mean, that's also why it's important to go to bed on time on Saturday night and not drink too much.
But like you said, I mean, if you're prepared and you've internalized what it is you want to communicate, then that is the key to being into it. It's not about, you know, popping a few energy pills or energy drinks before you get a pulpit, right?
Nor is it about eliminating a couple lines of Kyrie, because that won't do it either. I wrote one of the blogs I wrote early on that you published in your website was when I was taken surprise on Saturday night mass, and I went to church with my mother-in-law, and because she sometimes goes on Saturday, so on Sunday, and I think I wrote about it. There was her pastor was not there. And I like him a lot. He's really, really good. He's very my father-in-law. And he's, like, really, really good. So I thought, oh, I'm disappointed. So then this retired guy gets up there with a cane and limps around. But then, you know, when he preached, it was like he light filled the guy. And the thing that came across most of all was, well, two things. Number one, he was highly competent. He knew the text from a scholarly standpoint. I thought, well, he must be a professor. No, he wasn't. He was just a smart guy. The other thing that came across was he was really happy to be there. You could tell the guy, father, whatever his name was, he was enjoying himself. And so while it was 20 minutes, which is tough for you folks, right?
Yeah.
Catholic Church?
Yes.
It wasn't tough on the people in that parish because he was a frequent guest. And they knew old father, whoever he was, because, I'll just put it this way, he was that good. He was that good that the Catholic tradition of the 7-minute or 5-minute homily didn't apply because the guy was just that good. And that's a memory I have.
I want to, in the last few minutes of our interview, John, I want to come back to the original question and ask you to, if you can, kind of summarize why it is that we worship, and I'm talking about the worship now, in this liturgical setting and not some other kind of, well, what's on our mind today kind of modality.
Because the good news comes to us through one another and through our history and the history of our community. The good news of Jesus doesn't come to us out of a glad bag in the sky when we're singing Kumbaya. The good news, to use language from your tradition, has indeed been handed down. And to know that I'm hearing the good news the way my ancestors did and the way my children's children's children will, links me up with the living and the dead, and it links me up with a God who is beyond time. I just feel very, very, very strongly about that. The good news comes to us in incarnation. Jesus was like this guy with, you know, fingernails, right? And hands and feet and that. Well, that dignified human history, physicality, our ties and the ties that bind us. And to me, liturgy is both an expression of that, but also shapes it. It expresses it. In the early church, St. Athanasius, in his argument with Arius over the divinity of Christ, the clincher was, there were two clinchers. If Christ is not divine, then he cannot save. But the other clincher was, if Christ is not divine, then worship makes no sense. Because we worship, that was part of the argument for the divinity of Christ. And I guess that's where I'm coming from.
Well, that's a marvelous summary. I've been talking with John Berenson, retired Lutheran pastor from the Philadelphia area, and a regular contributor to the website magazine, The Christian Review. John, thanks again for being a guest on Church and Culture.
You're most welcome, Dale.
And I think at this point, John Berenson has been on this show more than any other single guest, and those of you who are listening will understand why. So,
and don't tell my bishop.
I promise. So all of you who have been listening, please join us again on Church and Culture at this time and on this day next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
You might have seen a copy of the Michigan Catholic newspaper sitting in the back of your church, but have you picked one up lately? If so, you'll find we're not only Catholic news you can trust, but Catholic news you can use. Find out where your favorite priest is being assigned, read our popular Q&A columns, and learn more about your faith by reading the Michigan Catholic. Talk to your pastor or call 313-224-8000 or visit themichigancatholic.com.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by our day sponsor. To celebrate the 35th wedding anniversary of Suzanne and Dan Taylor, parents to 7 children, 5 girls and 2 boys, and 3 grandsons. God has remained faithful to the Taylors, and they're truly grateful for His love. You can be a day sponsor too. Call toll free 1-877-288-1077 and say, "I want to be a day sponsor."
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, as this week of mid-Pentecost unites the resurrection with the ascension of our Lord, our special guest will unite Christians who are free with those who are persecuted.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
Hello, I'm Al Cresta. What is it about modern pop culture that makes it so difficult to detect the superficial? Well-crafted images, overblown advertisements, perpetual entertainment, and cool corporate brands all promise us the impossible and the contradictory, and they form within us extravagant expectations of what life holds for us. Every woman should be an airbrush supermodel, and every man should get himself at least one. In this digital age, we can surround ourselves with the products, the politics, the news, the music, and the programming we like and avoid dealing with everything else. We may say we revere God, but we are just as likely to try to be God with the flick of the remote. Teresa, Tommy, and I tackle the problem in our upcoming conference, What in the World is Real? Detecting the Superficial in Today's World. The conference is on Saturday, May 9th, from 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the Ford Motor Company Conference and Events Center in Dearborn. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and learn more. Hope to see you there.
Catholic researcher, writer, and consultant Paul Rondo focused on tactics, rhetoric, and strategy to sell the message and the truth at the Last Call to Holiness Conference.
First of all, if you want to penetrate the hearts and heads of an entire society, you're not going to know what's being sold to you. The first thing that's going to happen, you're going to be sold simply what everyone knows and everyone takes for granted. Even if everyone doesn't know and it shouldn't be taken for granted. Fetuses aren't babies, they're just part of a woman's body. Homosexuality is just like race. People are born.